This is CM Mayo. Welcome to cmmayo.podomatic.com.
You're about to listen to my talk about my novel, The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, for the Penn Writers Aloud reading series in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, which took place on the 19th of January, 2011. You'll first hear a brief introduction by poet and reading series director Bill Perlman, and then another brief introduction by writer Eva Hunter.
I'm Bill Perlman, running this Writers Aloud series for several years now. It's been a great pleasure for me, and it gives writers a chance to be heard by the community and also to raise money for our scholarship fund. Talk a little bit about International Pen. I was on online today. I'm preparing to direct a play by a Uyghur poet who is in jail in China at the moment. One of the things International Pen does is deal with writers who are in trouble worldwide. Some are in prison, some are having difficulties. And I myself actually can tell a story about being helped out financially by Pan American Center many years ago as a young poet. Now I'm an old poet and I need help too. But I'm going to give you a little of our history. San Miguel Penn and our president is here, Elizabeth. If you want to talk to her about Penn International, she's an expert. She's also a professor of Espanol in New York. Penn's a worldwide organization of writers with 145 centers in 104 countries, promoting friendship and intellectual cooperation among writers everywhere, fighting for freedom of expression, and representing the conscience of the world of literature. Our chapter in San Miguel is 30 years old, one of the oldest in the world, actually. And we had a big celebration summer before last. As I said, the donations you guys gave us go to scholarship funds, both Biblioteca scholarship funds and our Penn scholarship funds, which are used for young Mexican students who need help with their studies. I'm very happy to have CM Mayo with us today, and I'm going to turn this over to Eva Hunter, who's going to introduce Catherine Mayo.
The first time I met Catherine Mayo was at a writers' conference, the San Miguel Writers' Conference, I guess 3 years ago, four maybe, when I was the moderator of the panel that Catherine was on. And at the lunch that day, Catherine came up and said, "Can I sit by you?" And I said, "Yes." And I was really thrilled to see that in her hands were two of my books that were for sale. And that made me even more delighted with Catherine Mayo, that she had bought two of my books. Since that time, I found her to be not only a wonderful friend, but an amazing promoter of writing and other writers. And as a matter of fact, Bill and I co-edited an online literary journal called Soul English Writing in Mexico. And I must say that if it hadn't been for Catherine's encouragement, that would never have come about. So she's not only an amazing human being, but an absolutely terrific writer. C.M. Mayo is the author of The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, a historical novel based on a true story and named one of the Library Journal's best books of 2009. She is also the author of a widely lauded travel memoir, Miraculous Air, Journey of 1,000 Miles Through Baja California, The Other Mexico, and Sky Over El Nido, which won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. Mayo's other awards include 3 Lowell Thomas Awards, 3 Washington Writing Prizes, fellowships to Breadloaf, Sewanee, and Wesleyan Writers Conferences, as well as residencies at Ragdale, McDowell, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and Yaddo. Her stories and essays, mostly about Mexico, have appeared in Soul, English Writing in Mexico, The Kenyan Review, Literal, Paris Review, Massachusetts Review, Southwest Review, Tin House, among many others. A longtime resident of Mexico City and an avid translator of Mexican poetry and fiction, she is also the founding editor of Tamame, a bilingual literary journal turned chapbook press, and editor of an anthology of Mexican writing, Mexico, A Traveler's Literary Companion, which Mexican poet and critic David Huerta has called one of the outstanding contemporary works on this country. She teaches writing workshops at the Writers Center near Washington, D.C., in Mexico City and San Miguel de Allende. Currently, she is at work on a novel tentatively titled The Museum in the Parque Juarez. Catherine Mayo.
Thank you. The first order of business is, can you hear me? I'll do my best to project, but if you can't hear me, would you just raise your hand and then I'll try to raise my voice up. Thank you very much for the very kind introduction, Eva, and it really is an honor to have seen some of my work in Soul Literary Magazine, and I hope that that goes on to do great things. There's so many of us writing in English in Mexico now. We really need you. We really need you to keep going with this and do something with it. I think it's really exciting to see. Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Penn, San Miguel. It's really an honor to be here, and thank you all for coming. I thought what I would do today is talk to you about the novel, because it's based on a true story. Has a lot to do with Americans and Mexicans. But I invite you also, I'll leave plenty of time for Q&A at the end, and invite you to ask me any questions you may have about some of my other books as well. And when I'm finished, I'm happy to sign them if you want to buy them, or if you've already bought them, I'll send book plates for you. Or if you might want to maybe buy them later, I'll still send a book plate for you. And you can just come have a look at them here on the piano afterwards. One that I'd particularly like to mention that Eva mentioned is Mexico, A Traveler's Literary Companion. There are a lot of anthologies on Mexico. This is the only one that provides a portrait of Mexico in the voices of Mexican writers. There are many other anthologies of Mexican writing, but they pretend more to say, well, this is the important contemporary Mexican writing, and that's wonderful. But in reading it, you may not necessarily get an idea of Mexico because the story might be set in Africa or Paris. In fact, I translated Alvaro Enriquez, who's a wonderful, amazing writer. If you want to read Mexican contemporary fiction, try Alvaro Enriquez. His short story was set in Washington, D.C., Berlin, and California. Okay, so that's great. Okay, but that's not what my book is about. This is a collection of 24 Mexican writers writing about Mexico. So I invite you to have a look at that, particularly if you want to get to know Mexican culture and Mexican voices. So I'm really proud of this collection, so please come have a look at it. But what I'm going to read to you from today and talk to you from today is my novel. This is probably hard to see from there. The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, with this lovely little butterfly on it. And the Spanish version, I think, is a better cover. It has the actual prince on the cover. So this is our little prince here. And I'll pass him around so you can have a look. This is a novel based on the true story. I think you could... When I was selling the novel, back when I finished it and I had to pitch it to my agent and pitch it to the publishers, I said, it's the Mexican Gone with the Wind. You know? Now, it's not. The plot is very different. The personalities are very different. But it's set in the same time period, the 1860s. And well, I guess I should probably enter into a little bit of context for you. I know some of you are longtime residents or citizens of Mexico, and some of you may be here for the first time. So have you all heard of Maximilian and Carlota? Okay. And everybody knows about Cinco de Mayo? Maybe not? Okay. Well, basically, 1860s, while the United States was in the midst of its civil war, Mexico had a fairly unstable government, and not everybody was in agreement on everything, and Louis Napoleon thought it would be a marvelous opportunity to impose French interests, shall we say, in our hemisphere. So he put together a plot with the support of the Catholic Church and a small but not so small group of Mexican monarchists, and some other heads of state in Europe supported this, in particular Belgium, the King of Belgium. And England and Spain and several other countries, they didn't say no. So France invaded Mexico. And the famous Cinco de Mayo that we all hear about in the United States actually does not celebrate Mexican independence. What that is when the French came from Veracruz inland toward Mexico City, they got stuck at Puebla, which is nowadays a couple hours by car from Mexico City. You cannot take the capital, Mexico City, if you don't first take Puebla. And the problem is when they got to Puebla, the Mexican Republicans gave such a fight that the French had to regroup, and it took them another year to be able to come back and retake Puebla. So they were basically parked in Puebla for a year, which was very embarrassing to Louis Napoleon. It was a really devastating and very embarrassing defeat to him. But anyway, they did finally retake Puebla, and then the French marched to Mexico City and occupied Mexico City. All of this is happening while we're in the U.S. Civil War, okay? And so after the French had been in Mexico City for a year, they brought in Maximilian von Habsburg, who had been the Archduke of Austria, and his wife, the Princess of Belgium, Carlota. Maximilian Carlota came to occupy the throne as Emperor and Empress of Mexico. And again, this was supported by France, which at that time had the most powerful army in the world, and several other European countries, and the church, a very formidable institution in Mexico, and a not-so-small group of Mexican monarchists. If you read some of the contemporary histories, they'll tell you that, you know, these were all just foreign invaders, and et cetera, et cetera. But it actually is a more complex story than that. And then after a very brief reign, Maximilian was executed in Querétaro, and his wife, Carlota, went crazy. So a lot of people have heard of the story of Maximilian and Carlota, you know, this young imperial couple who met such a tragic end, to the point where I think there's been so much written about them that they've become almost kind of like cartoon characters, almost like cliches. And there are a lot of stories about them that are repeated and repeated and repeated, and that's not what this novel is. This novel is not the last emperor of Mexico. This novel is the last prince of the Mexican Empire. And the prince is a story that a few of the scholars who really knew the story of the empire had heard of, but most people had not heard of. And even what was in the authoritative texts on the Second Empire of Maximilian got a lot of things wrong about who this child was, what his role was, and why... Well, why it all happened. So anyway, the novel is about the last prince of the Mexican Empire, whose picture I've been passing around there for you. Those of you who came in late might not have seen it. And to help orient you a little bit, I realize the story is very large and very complicated. I have a little handout for you, which is partly promotional as well, to be completely blunt. It tells you... a tiny bit about the book. It has a plug for my Techniques of Fiction workshop at the San Miguel Writers Conference. And on the second page is a little bit more for those of you who read Spanish about the Spanish translation. And it has this picture and a blurb and so on and so forth. But most importantly is the website, because it's a very complicated period in Mexican history. It is essentially transnational. mean, we have the French, we have the church, we have the Belgians, we have the Austrians, we have the Spanish, we have the role of the British was actually quite important. Of course, the role of the United States and the role of the Confederates and the ex-Confederates after the Civil War coming to Mexico is a very, very complicated period. So a lot of times, I think it's very helpful for people when they want to come into the website to see some of the genealogy, some of the bibliography, some of the articles, videos, and I also have a whole talk that I gave at the Library of Congress about my research for the novel. The novel really required several years of original research, and one of the reasons why the Library of Congress is where I talked about my research is that this little boy, the last prince of the Mexican Empire, whose picture you're looking at, he is the grandson of Mexico's first emperor, Agustin de Iturbide. Agustin de Iturbide led the independence forces at the end of, oh golly, it would have been like 1820s. And he's not really very well remembered today because Mexico is a republic. It is not a monarchy, and it wasn't too happy about the second experiment with the monarchy. So Agustin de Iturbide, the Emperor Agustin de Iturbide, is a figure that I think Mexicans feel some conflict about. He's a controversial figure. To make a really long story short, his government didn't hold together, and he was executed, and his widow and her eight children, one of those eight children is the father of this little boy, ended up in Washington. And the Iturbide family has had a long association over many couple of generations with Washington, and that is why the entire archive of the Iturbide family and the Emperor Iturbide himself is in the Library of Congress. It's not in Mexico. So it required going in there. Now, it turns out that the mother of this little boy was an American from Washington, and what happened was that the son of the Emperor Iturbide, who grew up in Washington, ended up serving as a diplomat, in fact, the representative of the Mexican legation or embassy before the ambassador showed up in the late 1850s. At that point, he met his wife, an American, and then they came to Mexico, and then they had this baby, and then Maximilian showed up. Now, a lot of people have said to me, oh, this story of how the parents turned over the little boy to Maximilian, and the secret contract, and all this research you did. You know, it is so nice that this little footnote in history, you could turn it into a novel. And I always say, you know, it's not a footnote. When you go back and look at what is a 19th century European-style monarchy, the heir presumptive plays a political role of transcendent importance. And when we in the United States or Mexico, who are in a republic, we tend to forget that. I think we're always, particularly younger people, I think, we tend to see members of the aristocracy or the monarchy as celebrities that are kind of in Hola magazine or People magazine. And so we sort of see Prince William and Princess Di and Princess Stephanie kind of mixed up with Salma Hayek and Ricky Martin and George Clooney. And, you know, it's just like, you know, rich and famous people somewhere in Lake Como doing something or skiing. And we don't really realize, well, what does it mean to go back to 1860 with the blessing of the Catholic Pope to have an heir presumptive to a monarchy? In other words, this child was, for a brief period of time, the living symbol of the future of Mexico as a monarchy. And this was an idea that to us in the 21st century, and for most of the 20th century, might have seemed kind of ridiculous. And in fact, when you talk to many Mexicans, they think of Agustin de Iturbide, the first emperor, as kind of a ridiculous figure. They'll even laugh about him sometimes, like, oh, he crowned himself emperor, isn't that ridiculous? Oh, they had a court, isn't that wacky? You know, I think they tend to forget that this was a very powerful idea at that time, in that place, and being sanctioned by the church is just enormous. So what we're really talking about here is, what does it mean to be Mexican? Or what did it, or what could it have meant to be Mexican? Because if Mexico were to be a monarchy, this child was the living symbol of the future of that. That means that Mexicans would have been subjects. If it were to be a republic, they would have been citizens. And this is an enormously different concept, because a subject obeys and a citizen participates. So what this story really is about is the end of this idea, you know, sort of gone with the wind, the end of this idea that at one time was a very powerful idea in Mexico, and how and why it happened and how it ended. So the book tells the story of Maximilian and Carlota and the Second Empire, but through the lens of the story of the prince and how and why his American mother agreed to turn him over and then tried to get him back, which was quite a scandal. She went all the way to Washington and Paris and really, truly created an international scandal. One of the things I turned up, believe it or not, was the front page of the New York Times in January 1866, in which Maximilian was being accused of kidnapping the child of an American citizen because he wouldn't give back the little boy. So anyway, before I launch into a little bit more about the book, let me just answer a question I'm always asked, so I'm sure you have it, which is, well, if you went and did all this original research, why in blazes did you write it as a novel? And the answer to that is that I think that it doesn't make any sense if we don't understand it from an emotional point of view. I think we really have to go into Maximilian's point of view. We need to go into the mother's point of view, the father's point of view, or it just doesn't make sense. So it needs, although there's a lot of fact to back it up, there's a lot of research, and at the end of the novel, and in the epilogue, and also on the website, I go into a lot of detail about the sources. And if you're really interested in the sources, you can listen to my podcast of my Library of Congress talk, where I really go into all the archives. But the answer really is, I just don't think it makes any sense. An emotional truth needs to be told of why Mexico came to have this brief empire and this vision of the future that didn't work. I think that a novel, I'm not the best judge of my own novel. You'd have to read it and make up your own mind. And of course, reviewers have their ideas too. So I'm not really commenting on my novel per se, but just the novel as a genre, I think, although obviously it has its limits, it's very powerful, probably one of the most powerful way that we have as human beings to imagine another human being's life. It's even more intimate, I think, than theater or a movie, because you can really just be in your mind imagining the point of view of those characters. So it's really about compassion. It's not about sympathy. I do not ever ask the reader to feel sympathy for the monarch's cause. But what I ask them for, and I hope the novel manages to achieve this for you, is compassion, so that you can see Maximilian and Carlota not as these sort of cartoon figures of power, but as human beings who, you know, with all their flaws and all their value, you know, good and bad, to try to understand it. To give you a sense of why a novel, I thought probably the easiest thing to do is just read you a brief scene from the beginning of the novel. And this brief scene, it's about halfway into the first chapter. This is kind of a beginning to the answer of the question, why did the American mother of the prince get involved in all of this? So we need to, you know, people would say, well, she basically sold her child to Maximilian, right? I mean, she signed a contract where she said, I'm going to turn over my child and she's going to get paid all this money and become a princess and I don't know what, but she basically turns her child over. Well, again, if you just look at the flat facts, it just doesn't sound very interesting and it sounds very mysterious. Why would a person do that? But I think the novel, I hope, enables us to understand her as a person with all her good and bad and see how she might have gotten wrapped up in this. So this is a scene that takes place in the 1850s in Washington, D.C. And it's fiction, but it's closely based on research. So you can trust the portrait sociologically and politically speaking, okay? Her name was Alice Green, and it turns out one of the things I uncovered in my research that nobody knew, so I was very proud of this. She was the descendant of Governor Plater of Maryland and General Uriah Forrest, who was one of the aides-de-camp to General Washington. So she was from the aristocracy, as it were, of her time and place, Washington, D.C. And I got all this actually quite easily by just going to the Washington, D.C. Historical Society. There it all was. And her grandmother, Plater Forrest, was the portrait of the very distinguished lady in the vestibule of the library itself. So basically what you need to understand in order to have a sense of context of what I'm going to read you is that she was the elite of her time and place. Is someone trying to come in?
No.
They'll go around? No. Okay. And the other thing that you might need to know is that this takes place in the White House, which might seem very exotic, because for us, getting invited to the White House is a big deal. But in those days, in the 1850s, they just threw open the doors. It was called the levee, and it was the opening of the Washington social season. Okay, so I'm just going to read you this brief scene here to give you a sense of who she was. So Alice did go to the White House levee, and in her emerald green, her grandmother's rope of pearls around her swan-like neck and a camellia in her hair. With her sisters and mother, she joined the throng that snaked from the foyer into the reception room. They greeted President and Mrs. Pierce and then moved into the East Room. Anyone and everyone but outright vagabonds and Negroes, it seemed, had crowded in. There by the window, tete-a-tete, were Senators Jefferson and Slidell. An elfin gentleman in a plug hat and his frumpy wife admiring the chandelier. His Excellency, the Baron de Bodisco. Mrs. Taylor and Mrs. Riggs and Mrs. Lee and her daughter in the fleeciest of gowns and a wreath of white rosebuds. There was the usual slew of middies and army boys and also gawkers, of which the most rustic were those congressmen from the West. One could spot them from a country mile, and their wives in such gauche and badly made clothes. Leaving their mother with Mrs. Taylor, Alice and her sisters pushed through the crowd. They moved slowly, yet somehow she became separated from the others. For a time she wandered, shyly fanning herself. In the green room, the air greeted her with a freshness that hinted of long-off spring, for it was filled with a veritable forest of palm trees and ferns and staggering bouquets of hothouse blossoms that camouflaged there a pair of très distingués gentlemen, and there what she supposed were junior Senate clerks, and chittering away on a green and gold sofa, their wives. No one paid her the least attention, not even the waiter who bumped her and caused her to drop her fan. No gentleman stepped forward to pick it up. She had to retrieve it herself. No small feet whilst encased in crinolines. As she waded through the crowds from room to room, she was beginning to feel angry. Yes, that was it. Why should she play the ghost before all these nobodies, not worth a glance from Miss Alice Green of Rosedale? She swiped a glass of punch off the next tray that came floating by. She sipped it, found it too sour, and poured the rest into a potted fern. She had just about fixed her mind on going back outside to wait out this annoying party in the carriage when, nearing the door, she was stopped in her tracks by an excrescence of attar of roses. Its source was known to her, an acquaintance, a new member of their parish, Madame Almonte, wife of the as-yet-to-be-seen Mexican ambassador. It seemed the poor lady had found no one to talk to either. Had she just been looking out the window?
Her tired old face at the sight of Alice dropped its mask of anxious decorum. "Miss Green," she said in her atrociously accented English, which nonetheless came out with the authority of a headmistress, "I introduce you." Gripping Alice firmly by the arm, Madame Almonte steered her into the crowd, around the punch bowl, and with a push at the small of her back, right in between two gentlemen. Madame Almonte tugged the older man, who had the top-heavy aspect of a pestle, on the sleeve. "I introduce you, Miss Green." Then to Alice, she said, "His Excellency, General Juan Almonte." From beneath heavy dark brows, two obsidian eyes now fixed themselves upon Miss Green in nonchalant appraisal. A shade swarthier than his wife, this hawk-nosed gentleman had unmistakably Indian features, though these were compensated by sideburns well along in the process of turning a distinguished silver. He wore full court dress with gold braid, the buttons straining somewhat down his middle. He bowed deeply, the fringe on his epaulets swinging, and, with expert grace, kissed her hand. General Almonte. Alice had heard, she forgot where, that Mexico's ambassador had been in the Alamo with Santa Anna. He had a powerful charisma, and what seemed to Alice a most peculiar sense of humor. For no reason she could fathom, he gave her a lopsided smile and then winked at his wife. Still gripping Alice's arm, Madame Almonte turned to the younger gentleman who had been conversing with the general. "Miss Green, you know our legation secretary?" There before her, also in full court dress, stood Mr. Iturbide. They recognized each other from church, but it happened that they had not yet been formally introduced. Alice demurely offered her hand and curtsied. "Enchanté," she said, as Mr. Iturbide's mustache brushed the back of her glove. Mr. Iturbide wore the most attractive and unusual fragrance. It had, was that it, a hint of vanilla and lime? As all Georgetown knew, Mr. Iturbide was one of the sons of Mexico's George Washington, as it were. Unlike General Washington, however, General Iturbide had set himself up as emperor. His brief reign ended with his abdication, exile to Europe, and when he soon after, very improvidently, returned to Mexico, his execution before a firing squad. It was under the protection of the Holy Roman Church that his widow and her children had come to Washington to live on Georgetown's Holy Hill near the Jesuit College and Visitation Convent. Though the Iturbides could have, they did not use their royal titles. Having arrived here as a small boy, Mr. Iturbide spoke English just like a Yankee, and he looked with his pallor, his sad eyes, raven black hair, and broad and thoughtful forehead, the very twin of Edgar Allan Poe. Though, unlike the famous writer, the debonair Mr. Iturbide gave no indication of being anything other than an exemplar of rectitude. It was, as the French say, a coup de foudre. So Alice Green of Rosedale. Those of you who've been to Washington, you probably remember the cathedral. If you go up Wisconsin Avenue past Georgetown, you'll see the cathedral on your right. Her family's home, Rosedale, is two blocks behind that on Newark Avenue. At that time, this was all countryside. Of course, the cathedral hadn't been built yet. This was one of, actually, it's probably the most important historic house in the district. And it's since been, you know, now it's a place where a lot of doctors and lawyers live. But it's still there. And if you Google it, you will find it. It has a dog park for $50. You can get a dog tag. But when I started my research in the late 1990s, you could Google all day long, and you would never find anything. So it was really a bit of a coup for me to figure out who was Alice Green.
When I saw her name mentioned in some of the Mexican sources, they put Grin, G-R-I-N. It is Green, and I thought, well, Green is, doesn't sound like a particularly distinguished name. So I imagined, and for someone at that time to marry a Mexican was really very way out, you know, and leave your family and go to Mexico when you couldn't just take the next United Airlines flight back, you know. So I just imagined that she was, who knows, you know, nobody ever commented on her, so I figured she's, you know, fulana de tal, you know. But it turns out that, in fact, she was, as I mentioned, from this very, very distinguished family, and she grew up at Rosedale, which was a very, very important place in the history of the district. So, you know, this was a place where, you know, George Washington came to dinner, and they were all interrelated with the Lees and the Fitzgeralds and all the old families, all the old society of Washington. So one of the things I had to do to write this book was read a lot and do a lot of research just about Washington society in the 1850s. And that was really very interesting. But of course, it has a lot of tones about race. It's impossible to get away from that. And so you probably sensed a little bit of that, of like, well, okay, General Almonte, you know, like he's the ambassador and he's in court dress, but colored people can't come in here. You know, so it's kind of complicated. It's kind of interesting. And of course, the family had slaves. And it was, well, you know, it was Virginia, Washington, D.C. in the 1850s. Very, very complex period. So anyway, she married Agustin de Iturbide's son, Angel, known as Angelo in the family. And they then came to Mexico City. And soon after they came here, the French invaded. And at the time that the French retook Puebla and came into Mexico City, the baby, the prince of the novel, had just been born. He was a little baby. And so then by the time Maximilian and Carlota showed up, another year after that, he was still a very tiny baby. But, you know, if we go back to 19th century monarchy and we start thinking about this, Carlota and Maximilian had been married for several years, and they had not had children. And so this was actually a very unstable situation, particularly for Carlota, to not have children. For all appearances, it's still a kind of a mystery, not be able to have children. And one of the things that I got kind of after meditating on this for a long time and reading on this for a long time, was I realized, well, Carlota was not just the daughter of the King of Belgium, Leopold I, but she was also the first cousin of Queen Victoria, and she was also the granddaughter of King Louis-Philippe of France, who abdicated in 1848. So she actually was in France with her grandfather when he was king. So she was a person who really was culturally French. Her mother was Princess Louise of France, and very, very aware of the history. She was beautifully educated for her time and place, and she was very, very aware of the history. And I think something that would have been very prominent in her mind was the fate of Josephine, the Empress of France, who you probably all remember, Napoleon Bonaparte divorced because she could not have children. So when we go back, and again, when we think of monarchs in their more 19th century political sense, not as like modern celebrity sense, an empress who cannot have children represents a threat to the state. So she can be killed. She can be divorced. She can be gotten rid of. And so I don't think Carlota was paranoid to think that. I think that was actually very realistic on her part. And so this explains why one of the mysteries that I found was that Carlota did in fact negotiate with the Iturbide family. She performed all the negotiations privately with them. And then when it was time to sign the contract, she didn't sign it. It was the family and Maximilian, but she had negotiated it all. And so I think she clearly had an incentive to do so, because that way they would have brought this child into the court, not as their own child. This is another really important point. A lot of people say, oh, the child was adopted, and Maximilian Carlotta were like his parents, and that is really not the case. If you look at the contract, that's not what happened. He was brought into the court as a family member in the broadest sense of the word, a member of the house, the Casa Imperial. So the way that they would have considered him is as a cousin. They all called each other cousins. The royalty called each other cousins because they were, in fact, cousins. And Iturbide, the Emperor Iturbide, was a very minor noble extraction, so they did not consider him of royal blood. But he had, in fact, been an emperor of Mexico. That counted for something. And certainly the realities of the time and place were that, I think, very rightly, Carlota and Maximilian felt that we need to have an important Mexican family, that would be the Iturbides, showing their support for our government. This is the nationalist, you know, pro-Mexican, conservative, monarchist, Catholic party saying, we support Maximilian and Carlota. And that was effectively what this contract achieved in their mind, that it was a way of co-opting possible nationalist, monarchist opposition to what they were doing, and they had an heir in place. Now, the reality was, somebody actually dug another story out of the archives fairly recently, which it was an Austrian researcher found documentation that during this period, Maximilian had actually been trying to get his younger brother to send a nephew, a real Habsburg nephew, over to serve that role. But the family didn't want to cooperate. So the little Iturbide child was kind of, you know, he was kind of like a marker in place at the time. So again, they didn't consider him their son. He didn't consider them his parents. That's a very erroneous idea. That's really a more modern middle class concept of the whole thing. This is royalty. This is different. But nonetheless, he was, in effect, the heir apparent. So he was truly the last prince of the Mexican Empire. So a big question really is, what was it that so dazzled Alice, the American from Washington, into cooperating with Maximilian in this really crazy scheme? And I think the answer to that is in this next scene that I'm going to read you. This takes place before Maximilian has made any offer to the family. And this is the winter of 1865, which is when the French had taken most of the territory, not all. They never got all of it, but most of it. They were in pretty much full control of things, or as full as they could be at that time. And Maximilian had just arrived. He was spending money like crazy. He had money to spend still at that point. And I think another thing that would be very helpful to keep in mind is that I think even most Americans today, if British royalty walked in the door, we'd all get butterflies in our stomach. But if you multiply that by like times 10 plus George Clooney plus, you know, I mean, I really think this is the effect that Maximilian had on people at that time. To us, he might seem like kind of a minor aristocratic figure, but at that time, he was the younger brother of the Kaiser, and this was big, okay? So this is a description of one of the first balls that Maximilian gave. And this also, like the one I just read you about the levee in the White House, this is also based on a lot of primary sources and research. So sociologically and politically, you can trust this portrait of how things were done. So this is Mexico City in 1865 when the little boy is just a baby, okay? And the people that you need to know of in the scene are Alice, who now calls herself Alicia because she's in Mexico. And her husband is Angelo or Angel. And her sister-in-law, who is much older than she is, in fact, her sister-in-law is almost as old as her mother, is Pepa, Josefa de Iturbide, who is a spinster. And it turns out, in fact, she had a great deal to do with all of this arrangement with Maximilian. The winter of 1865 saw the first formal ball in the imperial palace. And at last, the Iturbides were invited, or as Alicia's oldest brother-in-law, Agustin Jeronimo Riley, put it, commanded to appear. On the appointed evening, at the appointed time, for they had been advised that latecomers would be locked out, Their buggy moved slowly through the throngs of Indians and gawkers. At the main doors of the palace, French zouaves armed with rifles and batons pushed the crowd back, away from the descending guests. Above the palace roof, illuminated with alternating red and green lanterns, the Milky Way sparkled in a chilly sky. Beneath their mantones, as they called their embroidered Chinese silk shawls, Alicia and Pepa wore gowns of satin and tulle, not new, alas, but refashioned by the best mantua maker in Mexico City after the latest patterns imported from Paris. Pepa's décolletage glittered with one of her mama's antique necklaces. Alicia wore her grandmother's rope of pearls and earrings, a gift from her husband on the birth of their son, which were also of pearls. They had been advised that the protocol of an imperial ball was both strict and elaborate. Gentlemen had to bow, women to curtsy. One could not speak to a highness unless spoken to. Alicia had only read about such things. By comparison, a White House levee, with its bumpkin of a president, was a rustic pileup. Oh, that Potomac backwater, with its third-rate consular bureaucrats. Those were as reed birds to real eagles, as donkeys to a pasha's elephant. If those bells from Lafayette Square and Georgetown could see her now, to think that anyone had looked down upon her marrying a Mexican and going to live in Mexico, things were going to be radically different with a Habsburg here. That was clear to Alicia from the moment she caught sight of the Palatine guards, Vikings in snow-white coats and silver helmets shining in the dazzle of fantastic torches. And inside, the gargantuan Venetian teardrop chandeliers, dripping light over the rustling mass of perfumed guests, officers and diplomats in dress uniform, civilians in tails and white tie, the women alight with jewels, hundreds of people, indeed, perhaps 1,000, were all craning their necks. Who had been invited? Whom did one recognize? Don Roberto, qué gusto. Ceci, qué tal? Alicia recognized a Mexican countess, the Hungarian cavalry captain who lodged down the street, the Belgian ambassador, and, in a huge velvet cummerbund and a diamond the size of a garbanzo bean in his cravat, Don Eusebio, the richest man in Mexico. A buzzing roar filled the air of the stairwell. Kisses for friends, handshakes for acquaintances, and up the crimson-carpeted stairs they swarmed past tapestries, Sèvres vases, wondrous peacock-like bouquets. Once, in the main hallway, still clinging to her husband's arm, Alicia happened to look up. The cedar beams had been gilded. It was hard to believe. This was the same lice-infested wreck that Doña Juliana de Gomez Pedraza refused to inhabit back in the 1830s, when her husband briefly had been president. Neither had Alicia's father-in-law lived here. The Emperor Iturbide's palace, so-called, was now the Stagecoach Hotel on the Calle de San Francisco. What's more, their majesties were only using this palace for formal entertainments. Though they had apartments here, they had established their imperial residence in Chapultepec Castle, which had lately housed the military college. This Alicia completely understood, for, as she had remarked to Mrs. York and others, her family's country estate, Rosedale, was at the same easy commuting range from the city of Washington. If the inside of Chapultepec Castle were half as sumptuous as this, it would be something out of a fairy tale, Alicia thought, pressing her hand to her fast-pounding heart, sincerely hoping that one day she might be invited there also. The Imperial Palace extended the entire length of the east side of Mexico City's Plaza Mayor,
The rooms given over to the ball were one extravagant stretch of brightly lit parquet after another, all drapes and mirrors and chandeliers, until they ended with the closed doors of the throne room. At 9 o'clock, the doors to the street were bolted, and now the master of ceremonies, with the aid of a silver baton and two assistants, divided the crowd, the ladies to line up along one wall, gentlemen the other. The buzz faded to whispers, and then a sudden hush. Alicia went up on tiptoes. Yes, the doors to the throne room had swung open. Soon she could see Maximilian in his Mexican general's uniform greeting the men, and the Empress, trailed by her ladies of honor, working her way down the line of women. Carlota's dark hair was arranged cushion-like over her ears. She was not wearing a diadem, but al español, a single blood-red rose. Her necklace and bracelets were of diamonds. These sparkled in the candlelight. Her gown was of mint green and scarlet brocade with a train of gossamer lace. She moved smoothly with hauteur, relieved now and then by the slightest of smiles. Next to Alicia, two rotund little señoras, nervously fanning themselves, began whispering and giggling. "Shh!" Pepa scolded. It was an effort to stay back near the wall. Everyone wanted a better view of the approaching imperial couple. Always one of the assistants to the master of ceremonies nudged them back. Alicia could now hear the conversations, Carlota's murmurs of enchanté, and some question about the work on the telegraph, or in Spanish, a bland buenas noches. Carlota spoke the language of each lady she addressed, a word of Spanish here, Flemish there, German or French or English. This daughter of the King of the Belgians spoke no less than 7 languages. Alicia could feel butterflies in her stomach. She batted her eyelashes and her hand flew to her pearls. Her turn had come. She tipped her head forward and sank into the reverent curtsy she had been practicing all week. Once she straightened, Alicia was startled to realize that she and the Empress were exactly the same height. "Buenas noches, señora," Carlota said, and said the same again with a slight nod, her diamonds flashing, as Pepa bowed her head. But as her hip was troubling her, she did not curtsy. The Empress was about to move on when Madame Almonte, chief lady of honor, rushed up and whispered into the Empress's ear. Carlota turned to Alicia and said, in an unnaturally slow, deliberate, perfectly pronounced Spanish, "Señora de Iturbide, we are pleased to have you here." "Ma'am, oh, delighted." Alicia's voice came out strangely high. Carlota said, switching to English, "Oh, you speak English?" "I do, I did. Oh, did I?" Pepa interrupted. "She is from Washington." "A very beautiful city, I hear, with the boulevards of Monsieur L'Enfant." And before Alicia could recover, Carlota had moved on down the row and was greeting the wife of the Mexican foreign minister. One of the really fun things in researching this book was that I came upon an original copy. It was lent to me by a friend who had inherited it, of Maximilian and Carlota's Book of Protocol. And it's about, it's bigger than this. It's a little bigger than this, and it's about yay big, covered in very elaborately tooled leather and a little sticker that says, "This is property of His Majesty. You have to return it, and here's the number, and here's the..." But I guess they never returned it. And it was very interesting to see it because, you know, a lot of historians talk about how on the journey from Europe, which took several weeks, what Maximilian and Carlota did was they wrote the Book of Protocol,
which is very elaborate. What I just described to you in the ball is pretty standard stuff, but I mean, they have everything from, you know, there's Easter Sunday and there's Good Friday and there's the baptism. And, you know, like if you're this level, you get a velvet cushion. And if you're that level, you get to hold the towel. I mean, it's very European, very Spanish kind of protocol. And a lot of historians will make fun of this, you know, like, look at this ridiculous stuff, and that's what they spent their time doing. And it really does seem kind of laughable when you're reading it. But again, when we go back to the 19th century and we think about, well, what in their mind, so I'm not asking you to agree, I'm asking you to understand. In other words, I don't ask for sympathy, I ask for compassion. What was their understanding of this? And this protocol, this sense of prestige was an instrument of control. It was a political, an instrument of political power. And in this scene, I tried to show how, indeed, subjects were dazzled by this kind of thing. But of course, Benito Juarez, being the president of the republic, had a very different conception of what it meant to be Mexican. It was to participate, to be a citizen. So, of course, he wasn't going to spend money on all these chandeliers and pots and pink champagne and protocol. So it's something that begins to become less ridiculous and more sad, really. It's just sad. But I don't think it's laughable. I think it's something understandable. And if you're interested in knowing more about the Book of Protocol, I have quite a bit about it on my webpage with some excerpts, and I translated a few of the chapters on the lunches so you can get an idea of how really elaborate it was. I mean, it was down to the colors of the socks of the waiters, you know, depending on the class. It was just really, really way out. But they wrote that book. I'd like to leave a lot of time for Q&A. We still have a margin of time, no? But what I thought I'd do, since I read to you, the two sections that I read to you from the book are both from Alice, the mother, the American mother. They're both from her point of view. But the book actually has a very unusual structure in that it has multiple points of view. And I teach fiction writing, and one of the first things that, and I know Eva does too, so she's going to laugh when I say this, one of the first things that happens when you see somebody with too many characters, too many points of view, is you can pretty much pounce on that right away and say, you've lost control of your narrative. Who's your main character? What does your main character want? And this is one of the reasons why it took me so long to write the book, because I kept feeling like there are too many characters, there's too many points of view, I need to focus. And it finally took me a long time to realize that the main character is not any one person. It's not Maximilian. It's not Alicia. The main character is the symbol, the last prince. Not as a human being. He's 2 years old, but as a symbol. And where does the symbol live in people's minds? It's a big idea, the future of Mexico, the meaning of what it would have meant to be Mexican. This is a big idea. So it needs to go into Maximilian, Carlota, the mother, the Pope, the kitchen maid, the bandit, the guardistas. We need to go into all these different points of view. There is no one character that could have told the whole story. It needed to be that way. At least I felt confident that that was true, so I proceeded and convinced my editor. He agreed with me anyway. But it is one of the challenges of a book with a lot of different points of view, that we are constantly switching, and you do have to keep track of a lot of different people. So that's another reason why you might find the webpage useful, because I have a cast of characters. And one of the things about the cast of characters is that I can go into a little bit more detail about who's fictional and who's real. And one of the characters, this is the last little section I'd like to read you. It's a different point of view. It's a very different character. His great-great-nephew found it on my website and emailed me. And that just really blew me away. And then shortly afterwards, some of the the great-great-nephew of Alicia, who's a lawyer in Virginia, and came over for tea. I mean, they found me through the website, so I said, well, come on over. So it was really interesting, and you know, one time when I read the scene of the ball, I was in Washington, D.C., and there were a number of Mexicans who came from the international embassy community there. And one of them started to cry in the middle of this. And I was going, what am I saying to make you cry, you know? And it turned out that when she was a little girl, they had this ball gown that had belonged to her great-great-grandmother, and they had always been told she wore this to the ball that she was invited to when Maximilian was here. And I think that what was, and she said, oh, it was true. So it was true. They really had balls like that. I said, yeah. And so then she started, that's what made her cry. And, you know, for a lot of Mexicans of, particularly I think my age, you know, I think, well, some of you maybe want to comment or question about this in the Q&A section, but I think it's a very, it's a very, there's a lot of conflict people feel about it, because the way you're taught in school and what you're taught as a Mexican about what happened is one story, but then what if your great-great-grandfather was one of the people in Maximilian's court? You know, you would feel a little conflicted about it, being told that you were a bad guy, but knowing that, well, but he was a good guy and he was trying to do the right thing. So there's a lot of mixed up feelings about this period. I don't think the analogy is the same, but if I could make an analogy, I would say probably some of the feelings people have about the U.S. Civil War, it's similar. There's a lot of complicated feelings about it, and different people told different stories. But anyway, I'd like to read you one last section to give you a sense of how there are so many very different points of view in the novel. And this is just a very brief scene that takes place a little bit more than halfway through. And this is when, this takes place in the winter of 1866. So this would be about a year after the ball scene. At this point, Maximilian has custody of the prince. The parents have been exiled, and they are trying in Washington and Paris to exert political pressure to get their child back. Maximilian is facing a lot of problems. He's running out of money. The French army and the Mexican Imperial Army are starting to lose a lot of territory, a lot of very important battles. It's a really difficult and dark time. And in the middle of all of this, in December of 1866, and they find out in January, Carlota's father, the king of the Belgians, who had been one of their main allies, he was a very influential person among the other monarchs in Europe. He was Queen Victoria's uncle. He died. So they lost one of their main allies. Plus, it was her father. So this is just a really difficult time. And in the middle of all of this, there's a new king of Belgium, right? King Leopold II of Congo fame, subsequently. This is Carlotta's brother. So the new king of Belgium sends a group of ambassadors to Mexico. And of course, this is politically very important for Maximilian and Carlotta, because they're going to go back to Europe and report on what they see. And, well, what happened, I'll actually go ahead and tell you what happened. One of the ambassadors was killed by bandits on the highway. So many people, when they wrote their memoirs of this period, or they write the history of the period, they say the murder of Baron Duarte in Rio Frio, we all knew that was the end. You know, the end didn't come for another year and a bit, but we knew that was the end. That was it. So this is that chapter, and what was kind of fun about it was entering into the soon-to-be murder victim's point of view. He was this very young Belgian having a good time. And again, as I say, what really kind of wigged me out was that one of his relatives sent me pictures of his, all sorts of things of his through my email. So that was really kind of wacky. So these were real people. So I'm just going to read a little section of this. I won't read the whole chapter, but it should just give you a flavor. So winter 1866, the Belgians are returning to Belgium, and the way they're going to do that is they're going to take the same route that the French took when they came in. They go Mexico City, Puebla, Veracruz. Mexico City, Puebla, Orizaba, Veracruz. And near Puebla is Rio Frio. It's a little spot on the highway. The Belgians had enjoyed their visit to Mexico City immensely. Although it had not gone unremarked, feathers were ruffled, that Maximilian remained in Cuernavaca, and that certain senior French officers did not attend the entertainments. In all, they judged their mission a success. They were proud of Charlotte, their own princess,
Swan of our old world, gifted to the new, as one of their members toasted her after having imbibed a few too many cups of champagne and made some tasteless remarks about our ginger-colored protégés. Also, they had seen an exotic land. They'd had a true blue adventure, and their steamer trunks and valises were crammed with the souvenirs to prove it. Of the delegation, no single member was more satisfied, more inspired, more, well, overflowing with joie de vivre about the whole thing than Baron Frederick Victor Duart. An intimate friend and officier d'ordonnance of Charlotte's brother Philippe, Duke of Flanders, Baron Duart might have been described as dashing had he not developed a paunch and double chin. Since departing Ostend in late January, he'd been unable to maintain his regime of fencing and hunting. The crossing had been brutal. For days, frigid gales had tossed the ship like a firkin in a tub. Some feared they'd be shipwrecked off the Azores. Unlike the others, confined to their cabins with nausea, Baron Duart often joked he must have had Viking blood and went on eating and drinking without pause. By the time they docked in Veracruz, he had consumed prodigious quantities of foie gras, bonbons, and champagne. And in Mexico, well, was there anything more delicious than a humble taco of beans with this marvelous sprig of an herb called the epazote? And he indulged in the candies, dulces de cacahuates, the cigar-shaped camotes, lime skins stuffed with sugared lard, and the almond nougat buttons soaked in honey. Baskets of candy were left in his quarters and replenished each day. At the farewell dinner at Chapultepec Castle, under his cummerbund, he had to leave the waist of his trousers undone. The round of balls and dinners had been intense. All of the Belgians, and especially Baron Duart, were limp with relief to finally get out of court dress. The coats bristling with decorations and epaulettes, the clanking swords, the hats with feathers. This morning, for the first leg of the journey home, he'd thrown on his roomiest breeches and favorite deerskin jacket. He is riding up top with the driver, who wears a sombrero with the circumference of a buggy wheel. Baron Duart had started out wearing his sombrero, a loosely woven one, not so big as the driver's, but the biggest they had in that labyrinth of an Aztec market. But once the coach climbed to an altitude and the air turned chilly, he exchanged it for the poppy red cap he wore for grouse hunting in the autumn. It is late. Their coach has just departed from the inn at Rio Frio. The sun having fallen behind the trees, the road is bathed in the blue shadow of the brief, disconcertingly brief, Mexican twilight. Baron Duart throws his shoulders back and fills his lungs with the pine-scented air. Que fresco! How fresh, he says, eager to practice his Spanish on his companion. The driver, throwing his lash, makes no reply. Had the driver been a Belgian, Baron Duart would have been infuriated by such insolence. He would have had him fired. But the driver is a Mexican, to Baron Duart, a creature who forms a part of a tableau that is, in the altogether, picturesque. Baron Duart simply shrugs. He thinks to himself, vraiment, these Mexicans are an inscrutable race. But Mexico itself, why, Charlotte had every right to be proud. It is a world richer than he'd imagined. A land of desiccated cacti? Hardly. Such a wealth of haciendas. They'd seen many from the highway, and they'd been shown photographs. Vast plantings of agave, corn, sugar, coffee, cotton, and hemp. And what breathtaking scenery. Why the devil is he the only one with the gumption to enjoy it? He could not bear to keep himself cramped inside the coach, everyone smoking, snoring, sweating, when up here one can partake of an ever-changing panorama. Now, an alpine Eden of rocky cliffs, sparkling rivulets, this forest for the knights of the Grail, in the slice of memling blue above, an eagle soars. He does not know the word for eagle in Spanish. He points at the sky, pájaro grande, big bird. Again, the driver makes no reply. Again, Baron Duarte shrugs, though this time with a sad little sigh. He gives his cap a tug, and he muses. Mexico City, Mexicans aside, well, it is a wonder. Its cavernous cathedral makes Saint-Michel-Iguduel in Brussels a mere chapel. Though Mexico's imperial palace could in no way be compared to the Gothic splendors of the Maison du Roi, it is nothing for Charlotte to be ashamed of. As for Chapultepec Castle, though excessively gusty out on the terrace, it offers far superior vistas than the Chateau Royal at Laeken. It is more on the order of Sorrento's. One had to agree with Princess Iturbide, the sunsets over the Valley of Anahuac are incomparable, may we, and ever so much more with the orchestra playing Chopin. Yes, they were shown the New World's land of Canaan, its oceans teeming with pearls, yet to be worked seams of gold, silver, copper, gypsum, fertile lands for tobacco, sugar, coffee, sisalhemp, cotton, and all what would need is a proper lash, troops of natives to work them. Mexicans, being an inherently indolent people, cannot be expected to progress on their own. The mining engineers come from Belgium, Germany, Italy, and France. The telegraph and railway men are preponderantly Englishmen, Yankees, and American Southerners. Commodore Maury, the world's greatest oceanographer, has offered his services to the Mexican Empire. Yes, what excellent fortune that the Confederacy has fallen, for so many of its good men have come to Mexico. Baron Duarte had had pleasant conversations with a Dr. Gwynne and a Colonel Talcott and a Judge Perkins. There were Confederate generals by the bagful, Shelby, Harris, and one by the most amusing name, Slaughter, who has set up a sawmill in Orizaba. Orizaba, on the way inland from the coast, when the Belgian party had stopped there, General Slaughter had given them a present of his oranges. Oranges! After those solid weeks at sea, after the heat and stench of Veracruz, that vulture-infested port where one hardly dared touch anything to one's lips, to have arrived in Orizaba, sweet-smelling Orizaba, to gardens of bougainvillea and gardenias, to cut open oranges squeezed over cups of shaved ice, ice from the volcano, the Pico de Orizaba, it was as a gift from Olympus itself. Phagomen kai piomen orion gar thanumeta, he couldn't resist quoting Epicurus. Then he drank a whole glass of juice, straight. And then it continues back on the journey. I'll stop there so I don't go on too long. But I hope this gives you a sense of how there are very different sensibilities. There's also some sections from the point of view of a maid, several from the wardrobe maid, a bandit, a warista officer, and a lot of it from the point of view of course, Maximilian himself. It really is... lots of different points of view. But let me stop here and just open it up for questions. So please don't be shy. Ask away. Yeah, Eva.
Well, Catherine, one of the things that I had a problem with getting my mind around and still do a little bit, though I think it's because I'm seeing Mexico through Mexico now, was why would a Habsburg prince come to Mexico?
Oh, I guess my novel didn't convince you. Well, it was really a constellation of factors, but one of the things that the novel goes into at the beginning in an entire chapter is Maximilian's point of view. And one of the things a lot of people don't know is that he had actually served as viceroy or governor of a large province of northern Italy that included Venice. His brother, Franz Joseph, was the Kaiser, and so it was traditional to give the younger brothers or the archdukes different provinces to basically govern. And they had a lot of unrest at that time with the Italian nationalists, and the military people close to the Kaiser felt that the younger brother was much too liberal, much too young,
And they basically shoved him out and clamped down, and I guess they mowed everybody down. And so Maximilian basically felt humiliated, and he felt very upset about this. Another thing that was going on, and I think from my understanding of matters, this was a fairly common political dynamic in this kind of situation, but oftentimes when there was an absolute ruler, people with a different sensibility who are loyal to the regime but don't totally agree with everything, they all kind of coalesce around a sibling or a relative. So a lot of people who had more liberal sentiments and a lot of Hungarians who wanted more independence were very friendly to Maximilian. And so the people who were close to the Kaiser viewed this as very threatening. And another thing that came up in my reading that I kind of got a lot more appreciation for over time was how, you know, even though the Kaiser was his brother and they're members of the same family and they're close in that sense, the Kaiser and an Archduke are both surrounded by a large bureaucracy and a court as well as an escort. And so it was politically, Maximilian was politically in a very difficult position, and he really didn't have anything to do that he felt really used his talents. He felt he had a lot of enemies at court, and Carlotta being, you know, the first, you know, the daughter of the King of Belgium, the granddaughter of the ex-King of France, the first cousin of Queen Victoria, she was very aware of what it meant to be a sovereign, and when she was newly married to Maximilian, she was the vicereign of Lombardy-Venetia. So I think that for her, she was only 24 years old. She had very firm ideas that she was meant to serve in a sort of mystical sense, to serve as a sovereign. And so a lot of these things kind of came together. But another thing that we often forget is, you know, when we know this story, we know how it ended. We know that Mexicans really did not want this. We know that Maximilian ran out of money. We know that the whole thing just didn't work. But if you go back and see it from, you know, 1860, 1861, they didn't have that information. So they didn't necessarily assign the same weight to different factors that we would, because they didn't have that hindsight. And one of the really key factors here was that Mexico was, in fact, for many decades unstable. It had had several changes of government, violent changes of government. It had been invaded by the United States, lost a lot of territory, and the governments the government that was currently running Mexico, which was the Juarista government, the Republic of Mexico under President Juarez, they were out of money. They were not paying their foreign debt. The country was somewhat lawless, and most importantly, the Mexican government had gone after the church and taken their property. So the church did not approve of this at all. Louis Napoleon was Catholic. His wife Eugenie was a Spanish Catholic. You know, for them, you know, Juarez attacking the church was like the devil. I mean, you know, he was not a hero. He was like the devil. And so they felt, well, you know, we're going to achieve something very fine, and we're going to help Mexico by putting, you know, proper civilized stability in here, Catholic prince. So this was their point of view. And again, I don't ask for sympathy. I ask for understanding. This is why. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying this is why it happened. But it was one of those sort of perfect storm things where everything worked out to put poor Maximilian in a completely untenable situation. Yeah.
Be royal somewhere. And poor old Max had been shot out of Italy there by the other faction. And also, I believe he had been told that the Mexican people really wanted him.
Yeah, he had been told that, yeah.
I mean, he also, from what I know, the Habsburgs thought they ought to be ruling somewhere.
And apropos of that, another thing I should have mentioned is that for us, with a sort of 20th, 21st century concept of things, it sounds kind of strange that this Austrian comes to Mexico. But going back to the 19th century, the relationships were very different. He was a direct descendant of the Habsburgs of Spain. So he felt that he was, by blood, related to the king of Spain at the time of the conquest. So it was this feeling that it was very natural, you know, to have a Habsburg on the throne of Mexico, that this was just completely normal and natural, and it was meant to be. And they saw it in this sort of continuation of the Spanish tradition in that way. So that sense of, you know, we tend to think, well, you know, here's Austria and here's Germany and here's this and here's that. But, you know, when we go back to the 19th century, it was sort of a pan-European feeling among the royal households. So that wasn't unusual. So that was another thing. It wasn't as an exotic a proposition at that time as it would sound to us today. Yeah.
I think quite the contrary was true. The notion of a republic at that time was new and novel. It was, you know, some of the things that George Washington did caused him to be criticized incessantly, and was the cause of the irreconcilable split between Washington and Jefferson, because he had, you know, monarchist tendencies. And so there was sort of a prevailing element throughout the New World, I think.
Very much so. And I think you know, one of the things that really came up for me a lot too was how recent the French Revolution was for these people at this time. It was something within living memory, if not of themselves, of their grandparents or something. Kind of like people, I was born in the early 60s. I didn't live through the Depression, but it was something very real to me because my grandparents talked about it all the time. So I think it was something that close. Maximilian's great aunt was Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France, who was executed. So this was very real to them, and the idea that, you know, Mexico should be a republic to them was just laughable, you know. So, ironically. Very much so. Which is funny, because now it seems like we've gone the other side, that democracy seems normal. It's more common. Certainly, yeah. Yeah. Not that long ago, very different points of view reigned, yeah.
Was there another question here?
I did, but it's been
addressed. Okay. Any other?
As a Canadian, I believe that the House of Windsor used the Princess Diana as a broodmare. They needed an heir to the throne. That whole idea has not died at all when you talk about the little prince being, you know, trying to make a connection, because it was such a disgrace that Carlotta didn't have any children. But
and we're in the throes of a second royal wedding at the moment.
Yeah.
And
it's still going on.
Yeah.
What's the timing of, like, the Monroe Doctrine and manifest destiny? Was that before or after?
It was before. So this was it's mentioned in the book a little bit, yeah. And later, the meat of the novel really is the story of the mother trying to get the child back as the empire starts to fall. And one of the things she did was she went to John Bigelow, who was the U.S. minister in France, or the ambassador in France under Seward. And of course, Seward's conception was that Europeans should not be in this hemisphere. That this is our hemisphere, or at least we should not allow others to influence it, and so that whole dynamic came up. I was going to say something else about that. It's a very big part of the novel, the role of and the attitude of the United States to this thing, and what to me was particularly interesting about it was that Bigelow and Seward were directly in communication with the parents of the little boy. And that I found in the archives. And one of the things that was particularly impressive to me was on the night that Lincoln was assassinated, some of you might remember that Seward, Secretary of State Seward, was attacked and they slit his throat. And he survived, but he was in bed. And he was in bed recovering from that when he received Angel de Iturbide, the father of the little boy, coming to say, please help us. We want to get our boy back. And one of the reasons that he received him was that they had known each other as colleagues in the 1850s when Washington, you know, was a small town. And Angel de Iturbide was serving as the head of the legation before the arrival of Almonte. You might have noticed in the first scene that I read you in the levee in the White House, there's General and Madame Almonte. And then Madame Almonte shows up again as the chief lady of honor to the Empress Carlota. So the Almontes had a lot to do with this as well. And that kind of ties in with U.S. and Mexico history as well, because Almonte was someone who had, in fact, been at the Alamo with Santa Ana. So it's kind of interesting to see all these little intersections of people and how it does connect with these larger issues of the U.S. and Mexico and their relationships. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I want to say thank you for that very point. I think we're taught history in such segments that are isolated from one another that it's really refreshing to see that all blended together. I'm learning a lot, and yet I was a history minor in college. I mean, this has been very entertaining. And to be able to do it in a novel form that touches you besides the academics, I think sounds like a good choice.
No, well, thank you. Well, let me just, unless there's another question, which I'll be happy to entertain if you'll let me, but I'll kind of maybe sum up at that point by saying that, apropos of that, to me this was what was really interesting, was that I also always had this idea that, you know, here's U.S. history, and here's Mexican history, and yeah, there was this invasion, and there was this thing during the revolution, and, you know, okay, but, you know, like, you could kind of put a little bell jar over each thing and read about it. But the reality is so much more complex than that. So much more complex than that. It's like there's this ocean and we see these big islands, but if you took the water away, you could see this very complex geography. Like, one of the things that, just to give you one more little example that has come up was, as I mentioned, after Appomattox, a lot of ex-Confederate generals came to Mexico. And so this would have been mid to late 1865, 1866. And, you know, so many of these people had fought with their opponents in the Civil War back when they invaded Mexico. I mean, many of them had been, like, I was just reading this new biography of General Magruder, who was the Confederate general who defended Virginia and Galveston, Texas during the Civil War, and then he came to Mexico, which is why it was interesting to me. But he had been in the invasion of Mexico in the late 1840s with General McClellan, you know, so these guys all knew each other, Lee and Grant, they were all together in Mexico in the 1840s. So, you know, there's this history, both, you know, at a larger conceptual level of, you know, a lot of people have said that you can't really understand the Civil War without understanding the U.S.-Mexican War and vice versa and all this kind of thing, but also at a personal level, and that people literally, they knew each other, or they knew people who knew each other. It was a very small world in many ways, and people, and particularly people at high levels, like royalty or some of the wealthier people, they really traveled. You know, they went to Rome. They went, I mean, way back in the day when it was a very adventurous thing to travel, but they really did get around. So, you know, like the parents of the child went from Washington to Mexico, and then they went back to Washington, and then they went to Paris, and then they went to Cuba. So there was a lot of movement and a lot of really surprising intersections. So I'll end it there, but I thank you.
Thanks for listening. Listen to more of my podcasts at cmmayo.podomatic.com. For more about The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, as well as my other books, articles, translations, writing workshops, and more, I invite you to visit my website, www.cmmayo.com.